This is my one and only slide, but I've neglected to put the title of this talk on, which I'll just read very quickly to you. Cosmological Foundations for the Promotion of Embryo Science, Technologies and Product and Process Technologies, that's in reference to Joel, in Pre-Industrial Europe and Late Imperial China. And I want to thank Chris, Rowena, Jeremy and Andrew for the pleasure of being here and the pleasure of being on a panel with some old and very good friends, and to seeing so many of my old friends here today who've been with me for some years, is in an evangelical way, proselytizing for the development of global history. Most of us here have been participants in a, if not the most famous debate in comparative economic history that aspires to become global. Floated long ago as 1981, as Jeremy said, by Eric Jones in The European Miracle, the current debate is now 22 years old. I mean, it's a thought, isn't it? We've been talking about this for 22 years. And was initiated by four books published at the turn of the millennium by Roy Bin Wong, David Landes, Gunder Frank, and above all, Ken Pomerantz. I intend to deploy the 20 minutes at my disposal to addressing as briefly as I can, with just one theme in the debate, that has endeavoured to explain when, how, and why a cluster of national economies at the western end of Eurasia attained levels of labour productivity and income per capita that left the great empires of the West, South, and East Asia for some centuries in a state of stasis or relative backwardness and geopolitical vulnerability. That's the Pomerantz question. We should all be grateful to the California School and also to the World Systems School of Emmanuel Wallerstein, who's just died very recently, for stimulating this debate and for rescuing the economic history at the end of the 20th century from the doldrums that it was in. This has been an exciting debate, and we've all really enjoyed being in it. And they've published a range of questions and theses that have reflected back on our own work as we've worked on Europe. The Great Divergence by Ken is especially memorable because it's replete with assertions, hypotheses, and fruitful errors, enough to become a classic in the field. It is truly global in scope and scale, and, as I said, has done a great deal for our subject. The when question we had this morning, and I'm going to leave that really alone, but the chronology is really a very important question to answer, and that's why, as Joel has said, a lot of us have spent years and years on the tedious task of trying to measure real wages and GDP, because it's very important to have a chronology, because it's part of our explanatory framework, and the Pomerantz book would not stand up without a peculiar and particular technology. I mean, he says the gap emerges very late. Joel and I firmly believe together, I hope I'm not misquoting you, Joel, that it started much earlier. David Landes thought it started 1,000 years before that. It started in the early Middle Ages. And medievalists here will no doubt agree with that sentiment. But anyway, so that's really I'm not going to deal with that because I've written three papers, as I said this morning, with my good colleague at the LSE, Kent Deng, in World Economics, the Journal of World History, and in the Economic History Review, saying that the Kuznetsian paradigm really is very, very difficult the further east you go. It was always very difficult to do anything about the Romanov Empire. But when you get to the Ottoman Empire or the Mughal Empire, let alone the Ming-Qing period, it is extremely difficult to find the kind of numbers that Simon Kuznets himself would have said those numbers will actually do. They are plausible conjectures. At the moment, I don't think we even have plausible conjectures. That was the thrust of the three papers that I wrote. My view is that given the absence of secure and plausible macro statistical data for the Ottoman and other empires that refers to these empires as a whole, which is what we're trying to do, that all we can do is to compare a familiar range of institutions recognized by economists, sociologists, anthropologists, and historians as obstructive or promotional for economic growth. I mean, we've been discussing this theory since Doug North's famous book, so we know quite a lot now. We've thought quite hard and long about the nature of the institutional preconditions for economic growth, and we can see whether they were absent or present in these great empires and to what degree. At the end of a long career in economic history, which goes way back to 1960, allow me to assert that there is or never will be a generally accepted theory amongst us for economic growth. We've been working along these lines for years. Nevertheless, amongst the multiplicity of factors and inputs that are promotional for that desirable process, and this has been virtually ignored by the California school and derogated by recent postmodern scholarship, is the view of the luminous and complex literature of cultures as if the cultures of Christendom, let's use the right word, it's a contentious word, as permeated by modern science. I mean, that's what I'm going to be talking about. That permeation was present in the Middle Ages, was gradual, cyclical, subject to repression, and confined to a tiny but increasing segment of European societies. John Hughes's Vital Few, which Joel was talking about, but he had a different vital few from the few that I have in mind, and my few is a little bit bigger than his when he gave a very good lecture at the Academy this week. This statement has become Eurocentric and contentious. Cultural permeation almost certainly accelerated between the times of Copernicus, died in 1543, and Newton, who died in 1727. The so-called scientific revolution, which I think was the label given to that particular period by Butterfield. He happens to be at Cambridge, but never mind, none of us are perfect. And his followers insist on designating that period as the scientific revolution, which has occupied a great deal of time in the history of science, because there are those who say it was a non-event, there were those who say it was socially constructed, and there were those who, like myself and the present professor at this university, who should be drawn into this meeting, actually, I'm sorry he's not here, Rob Iliffe, who does believe that science, in some sense, was an autonomous variable and input into the process of technological change. And I hope Joel actually agrees with that particular position. The cultural permeation that mattered for modern economic growth, characterized by structural change and a discernible rise both in labor and total factor productivity, to use the Kuznetsian language, based upon process and product innovation, occurred amongst the wealthy, political, and educated elites of Western societies, supplemented, as Joel will tell you, by an artisanal class, which was particularly strong in Great Britain, or particularly important in the British case. It emanated from a cosmography, which I will define as a set of beliefs about the natural world and prospects for its manipulation, which I've put in that last quote there. So what I'm doing in this lecture is moving from Mary Wright's famous quote. Dagmar probably knows that quote very well. She's a very famous, with her husband, two very famous sinologists who I very much like, to Geoffrey Lloyd, who's a classical scholar at Cambridge, and also to Nathan Sivin, another very distinguished sinologist who wants to talk about what I'm about to say some words about, just a few words. I'm not going to say very much because the ratio of assertion to evidence in this paper is, because I'm given just 20 minutes, very, very low. But if you want to know more, I do have a number of working papers that I can refer you to and a number of published papers which will substantiate things that I'm simply going to assert in a loud voice, which I trust, James, you can hear me at the back. Is that okay? Right, okay. Given that some, and alas to an unmeasurable degree, which worries all economic historians, when you can't measure a thing, it's not a fact or it's probably a fake. The social evolution of an optimistic cosmology that could only have been promotional for productivity growth in agriculture, industry, and services has become essential for historians who aspire to narrate and analyse divergence in order to ascertain if the evidence at their disposal might support the traditional Euro-centred, not Eurocentric view, because that's why I put those first two quotes. And I stand on those quotes, that long-run growth is inherently cyclical. It passes from location to location and has passed, as Needham pointed out, from east to west. And the question is, when did that actually happen? And that supported the Eurocentric view that the cosmography embraced by European statesmen, entrepreneurs, educated elites, and I will add, Joel, artisans, became distinctive enough to be represented as differentially significant for the divergence rates of material progress achieved by this cluster of Western European economies, which Joel insists was led by the British. And we're all very grateful to our American cousins for keeping us alive in this time of need with strong praise of that kind. We fall back on the past because the present is so dreadful to compliment. So,
it's not like it's all that great on the other side. You know.
So, I mean, the story is that Europe's Western national economies actually embraced this optimistic cosmology before the great empires of Asia and before the accession of the Ming in 1368 and the period, during the period up to and including the Industrial Revolution. To respond what is possibly an unanswerable question, they would have to read, if you're a historian with this view, you have to read and absorb what may be a whole impossibly long library of literature in many branches of history, particularly the histories of science, published about the cosmological beliefs and dispositions present in the cultures and institutions of the great Eastern empires, the Ming Qing Empire, the Mughal Ottoman, the Safavid, and the Romanov Empire, and to see how they contrasted, where they contrasted, and with what significance they contrasted with Western Europe and its settlements overseas, as Simon Kuznets called them. So the mega question for such an awesome program of reading and research is what kind of what I call regimes for the discovery, development, and diffusion of useful and reliable knowledge, a phrase used by Simon Kuznets, was operating and evolving across Eurasia before Western science and sciences engendered a dominant and universal cosmography for the comprehension and manipulation of the natural world. When, how, and why did the Western way of investigating nature actually achieve hegemony? I mean, that's what we economic historians have been trying to answer. So, and I'm going to stop now because I've just got this conclusion. After reading nothing more than a fraction of that vast literature on the histories of Eurasian science, technology, religion, cultures, and supervising postdocs who happen to have the linguistic credentials required to engage with meta-narratives that included India, Japan, China, and the Islamic world, and compared them and tried to compare them with the regimes to Europe, I remain a Eurocentred and possibly Eurocentric scholar and believe that namely for some three centuries preceding the Seriatim national breakthroughs into the accelerated growth of total factor and labour productivity and standards of living was accompanied by structural change, was prima facie established by Western Europe and gradually consolidated into regimes, modern regimes that we now recognise with scientific disciplines and techno-science for the development of economies. I have published and circulated two working papers, which in essence add little to what I've just said, to the brevity of this thesis, and add very little to what Joseph Needham told us many decades ago. I'm a confirmed Needhamite. This is the classical seminal study that this paper, or my papers, really rest upon. Furthermore, none of the postdocs that I worked with for 3 years at the London School of Economics on this mega question came up with evidence or views that the regimes comparable to the regime in Europe, operating and evolving, above all in China, but more clearly in Islamdom, called it, India or Japan, could be convincingly represented as anything other than very different and potentially less productive for the formation of a cosmography or set of metaphysical beliefs that was promotional for the formation of useful and reliable knowledge. Although in this our time of climate change, the cosmography of Imperial China, Dagmar, is beginning to look much more prescient. Although you have described it in your great book, which I read recently, as a scattered landscape of individual reactions rather than a linear, unified and corpus of knowledge in the making. And I think that's a wonderful quote, and I'm going to use it with your permission very often, and I hope you don't contradict what I've just said. So these are my assertions. They can be read in working papers and they can be read in published articles, and I'm now going to finish. Not on time, but I hope before
very
time.
Very much on time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.